101.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. You're not going to believe what happened when Kamala Harris's airplane, that's Air Force Two when the vice president is flying on it, and J.D. Vance's airplane, he's a vice presidential candidate, when they both land at the same airport at about the same time, and then J.D. Vance walks over to Kamala Harris's airplane. Not to talk to her. She wasn't out there. But the Secret Service and a whole bunch of reporters were there. You're not going to believe what he had to say. But let me get to that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We endeavor on this program to serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network every single day with honestly provocative talk. And you're invited to take part in the conversation. It's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer and you disagree with me, maybe you want to sing the praises of Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota, and the guy who got the tampon machines into the boys' bathrooms at public schools. If you want to be the naysayer, we'll be glad to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this one was strange. I saw the story, and I thought, well, I'm going to ask you this in the X-Poll question today. You remember the Titanic on the bottom of the ocean, and you remember that doomed submarine ride in which five people on board a submersible, technically it's not a submarine because, well, there's a complicated definition of what a submarine is, but we can get into that later. The question is, if you were one of the people on board that submarine, and the submarine failed spectacularly, and all of the people, sadly, on the sub died. Now, if you're a member of the family of Paul Henri Nargolet, a 77-year-old man who was one of those people who had paid a lot of money to be on that sub, to go down and see the Titanic on the bottom of the ocean, and then the sub failed and everybody on board died, is your family entitled to compensation in court for wrongful death? Now, my guess is no. My guess is that, like a lot of places, if you go and, you know, agree to do something like skydiving, you sign a form that says you understand that you're about to take part in a dangerous activity which can result in serious injury or death. I think I remember signing something like that the two times I did a dual parachute jump. That's where you jump with somebody who actually knows what they're doing. This guy got on board the sub, had paid a lot of money to do it, and sadly he died. His family now wants $50 million from the company that ran the submarine or submersible that was attempting to get to the Titanic and failed. You say, but they failed. You say, yeah, but you know, the thing is, the lawyers are going to point out this guy knew the risks. He'd been informed of the risks, and he likely signed a form that said, I understand the risks. I understand this can end in death. It did end in death. I have a feeling his family will probably get some kind of out-of-court settlement for a fraction of the $50 million. But if you were sitting on the jury and you were considering the case, okay, the guy goes out, he agrees to take a submersible ride, and the submersible fails. But he was told ahead of time that is one of the very real possibilities if you decide to do this. Would you, as a member of the juror, give his family a bunch of money as compensation for his wrongful death? I would not. I'd say he knew the risks. And, you know, he messed around and found out. So that's my answer. No, I would not give the family of the guy who rode the doomed submersible to the Titanic get compensation. But you can answer the X poll any way you like. You'll find the question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. And it's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday, I actually had somebody email me and say, why were you asking the question about whether or not we ought to castrate child predators? And I said, because for the first time in America, Louisiana has passed a law. It went into effect last Thursday, a week ago. And they said, if you are caught sexually abusing a child, raping a child under the age of 13, and you are above the age of 17, so you're an adult, then you may be castrated. The judge can use that as one of the punishments. I said, yes, more states should follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators. Now, oftentimes, sexual offenses against anybody are not sexual crimes as much as they are violent crimes, and they may or may not be driven by sexuality. I understand that technical answer. I just think it's justice that if you've gone out and raped a child, you should lose something. And in this case, something in particular, two of them, and the judge can do that in Louisiana now. I think it'd be great if other states followed their lead. Are they going to use that punishment very often? I suspect they will not. Will it likely dissuade a certain number of perverts out there from going after children? I think it will. Will it stop all of them? Certainly not. You know that some of those perverts cannot be stopped by anything short of the death penalty, and I'd put that one on the ballot, too, and see what the voters think about it. But the answer from the crowd, 94% said yes, should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators. 6% of you said no. And the reason I'm asking the question is when one state in America finally breaks that wall down and says we're going to do it, then I think that's a good idea. Now, I want to ask you this question. I don't think that the Americans with Disabilities Act is a bad idea in general and on paper. But in practicality, in the decades it's been on the law books, it has turned into, for some people, a shakedown opportunity. In other words, an opportunity for extortion. So I'll give full credit to OregonLive.com. I usually call them the Daily Dead Fish Rapper, but they did a good job in this case. And they documented a story that we've talked about generically on this show a number of times. Attorneys will tell you that there are people out there using the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, to shake down small business. And here's the way the fish rapper described it. 2 years ago, Connor Slevin, a man who's disabled and he's in a wheelchair, learned from a Facebook friend about attorneys from out of the state of Oregon who said they were going to go out and expand into the Northwest. And what they meant was he called them up and they said, sure, we're going to send you a list of a bunch of small businesses. You go out yourself in your wheelchair. You check out the situation on your own. Then we will go to the business and we will file a lawsuit against the business under the ADA. But of course, we'll always agree to settle out of court for a certain amount of money. Now, he's now suing the attorneys because while he made a lot of money, about $14,000, he made $200 every time he identified a small business that the attorneys could, as one judge described it, shake down. That was actually a federal judge who called it that. He said a shakedown because they did cookie-cutter lawsuits against businesses in the state of Oregon. And then Slevin would say, why, yes, I went to that business, and I'm a disabled person, and they don't meet the ADA. And then they would say to the business, you can make all of this go away for the right amount of money. Every month, the Tennessee lawyers emailed him lists of addresses of small businesses in the Portland metro. They told him they had already sent their inspectors, but they wanted him to visit, and then he became the plaintiff. Talk about an extortion racket. The folks who use the ADA for the right reason are to be applauded. These people should be condemned as far as I'm concerned. Glad to have you with me on a Wednesday. If you want to jump in to the Radio Northwest Network for the best conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Hey, I certainly...
Right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say... sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, America's legacy media plans to reinvent radical Minnesota Governor Tim Walz as a political moderate. Now, I know some of you are saying he's not radical. I mean, he looks like a guy you met at Home Depot. He looks like somebody's dad or grandpa. The former football coach certainly looks the part. Well, consider his record. The NRA, the National Rifle Association, once gave Tim Walz an A rating, and he badly needed that A rating because at the time he was a member of Congress from Minnesota, and his district, the one he won to put him on Capitol Hill, had voted twice for Donald Trump and once for George W. Bush. But as governor, Tim Walz flipped on guns. He now gets an F. He praises socialism. He's positively in love with communist China. He's taken dozens of trips to China. He got married in China. He even honeymooned in the People's Republic. You can imagine what that was like. Well, that's important as Biden chokes off America's abundance of energy, our own energy like natural gas, oil, and coal, and then proposes that we tie our future to Chi-Com windmills and solar. Well, Joe Biden is out in January, but if you get Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in office come January, can you imagine they're going to sell us out to the Chi-Coms just as bad as Joe has done? Only their families won't make nearly as much as the Biden crime family has made. Tim Walz supports gender mutilation of children in name of gender affirmation. He declared his state a sanctuary for illegal aliens. He even gave the illegals driver's licenses. And when botched abortions leave living babies, and it does happen occasionally, Walz Minnesota just sets them to the side and lets them die. I'm not kidding. That is from an official report from the state of Minnesota under Governor Tim Walz. Now, do you agree he's kind of a radical? When Minneapolis burned in the 2020 Antifa riots, Governor Walz stood by and refused to act. He wouldn't even call up his own National Guard. And in fact, he disparaged the National Guard, where he had served more than 20 years, as a bunch of 19-year-olds who can cook, while his new running mate raised bail money for violent criminals so they could get back on the streets. All in all, Walz makes Kamala Harris look positively moderate by comparison. It's a Wednesday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our question of the day today, is polishing a politician's resume a legitimate charge to the taxpayers? And if you say, well, of course it isn't, well, you've got some questions for Rene Gonzalez. Rene Gonzalez is a Portland city commissioner who's been invited dozens of times to come on this program. He's never agreed to do so. He's currently running for mayor of Portlandia. You know what he did? He recently spent more than $6,000 to kind of tune up his Wikipedia. Now, a lot of us in the public eye are on a Wikipedia. I didn't write mine. I don't edit mine. But apparently Rene Gonzalez thought it was appropriate to use more than $6,000 of the taxpayers' money to sort of polish up his image on Wikipedia. Gonzalez's office at City Hall hired a New York-based company. I guess we don't have enough code writers here in the Pacific Northwest, despite the presence of Microsoft and Intel and everything else. So he hires a New York City company back in March to develop a handful of requested edits to his Wikipedia page and also train a designee on the submission process. That's according to records obtained by Oregon Live. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, it's summertime in the Northwest, and we are very near to setting a brand new record for the greatest number of acres of wildlands owned by the public that have burned. Now, I've mentioned this a number of times before. I'm going to keep on mentioning it. Oregon, in particular, enjoyed more than one-third of a century from 1952 to 1987 with zero major fires, that is, fires above 10,000 acres. By comparison, we now routinely see 500,000 acres burn every single year. So to go from zero to 500,000 a year, and in extreme years, we actually see 1 million or more. We're well above 1 million acres burning right now. And the difference is, the states of Oregon and Washington stopped managing public forests. That includes the federal government, too. But if a fire is happening in your state, my argument has always been nobody's going to fault a governor who says, if the fire is burning here, I don't care whose land it's on, we're going to put it out. It is a huge story. It is your public resource that is going up in flames or in smoke. And if you're breathing the smoke, depending on where you are in the Northwest, there is a way to stop it, and you can actually make money while you're doing it. But the people in charge in both Salem and Olympia have chosen not to do that. Our best email of the day, but you can always send more, to talk@LarsLarson.com. Robert writes, Lars, I hope the Republicans are awake to what's really going on, the real reason that Biden is out and Kamala is in. Obama remains the puppet master pulling all the strings, all those claims about him not endorsing Kamala, just a game, and too many in the fish wrapper fell for it. Obama had to switch out Joe because they couldn't begin to cheat him again. Nobody on the planet would have believed Joe Biden won in November. And now with Kamala, they're creating fake poll numbers and claiming she's now within a point or two of Trump. They needed to get into the mindset of the public about Kamala. They can now cheat again using the plausible. Our great country is too close to being ruined. Signed, Robert. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Scott's on the line on this Wednesday. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, hey, I was just going to let you know that the Salem, the major homes camp there, is on fire.
Right now. Yes, and where is that camp located for people in the rest of the Northwest? Where is it?
It's near the Wallace Marine Park in West Salem.
Wow.
And I've heard it explained that it's probably our biggest homeless camp in the state, and it's ablaze. So,
well, thank you for the heads up on that, Scott. Are you anywhere near the fire? Can you see what's on fire right now or how big it is?
I can see it over the tree line, and everybody knows what's down there. So,
I got to tell you something, Scott. When I was a reporter for more than 20 years in TV and radio, one of the things reporters love to do is tell you statistics, like today's the coldest day or today's the hottest day. They're always all about the numbers. Have you heard a single reporter in the Pacific Northwest say what percentage of all the fires this year have been caused by people in homeless camps? Because I'm willing to bet it's well over 50%.
I'm willing to bet it, too. It's a bad use of tax money to spend it all there, and I drive up and down the freeways, and I see them. I hear them talked about on the news, but they don't necessarily say where it's from or who did it or what it's about. So,
well, let me tell you something. I know it's lunchtime, so I have to be careful about this, Scott. But just yesterday, Tina and I had run some errands, and we were getting back on a freeway. And, of course, along the freeway ramp was a gigantic homeless camp. You can not just see them, but if you roll your car window down, you can actually smell the homeless camps. And how's that for a tasty invitation to the Pacific Northwest? Aren't you ashamed of what the elected officials have done in both Oregon and Washington, and especially in Portland and Seattle, that their negligence is ruining once proud cities, and they need to fix it? And if they don't, you should throw them out at the election time. You're listening to a Wednesday on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, and I'm always glad to get to your calls, and I'll get back to those in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, imagine this. Over the years, over the decades, there have been plenty of stories about criminals who go out and they double sell things. They double sell a piece of land for a house. They double sell shares in a gold mine. I mean, there are lots of those kinds of schemes. But I'd never heard about double selling of a cemetery plot until I read this story in W Week, and Nigel Jake was the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from W Week, joins me now. Nigel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
I want to ask, first of all, does this appear to be something that was just an accident by Skyline Memorial Gardens, or is this just one of a number of occasions where they've sold the same plot to two people?
Well, you know, Skyline is part of a gigantic corporation, Service Corporation International, which owns 1,900 funeral establishments around the country. So they've made mistakes before. I don't think this was intentional. I think it was, as you said, an oopsie where they sold a plot to one family. The family put their son's remains in that plot, and a year or so later, they said, "Hey, we actually sold that plot to somebody else before we sold it to you."
What's the adequate fix then? If your family member has been buried there for a period, and I take it this period is more than a couple of days, do you go to the family you accidentally sold it to and say, somebody else already owns that plot, we have to dig you up, or dig up your family member and put him somewhere else?
Well, yeah. So I believe in Oregon you have to have a family's permission to remove their family members' remains from a grave. In any case, Skyline went to the family that had buried its son and said, "We made a mistake. We'd like you to move." She said, the mother of the child who was buried there said, "No." They said, "Well, look, we'll give you another plot anywhere else on our property," which is a big property. I think it's 55 acres. She said, "No. I mean, we've gone through, it took us 5 years to find this spot because we were so traumatized. Her son had been run over by a truck and killed in Florida right after his 20th birthday. So it was a very traumatic event for the family." She said, "I just don't want to do that." So Skyline eventually sued her. And then things got really interesting because the judge said, "Well, Skyline, you're not a party here. You don't have any interest. If the family that wants the plot, the original purchaser of the plot wants the plot, they have to come to court and make their case." So that family joined, but they said, we don't want the public to know who we are, judge, so we'd like to join under a pseudonym. So one of the fundamental principles, and what this case is really about in many ways, is about the fundamental principle that courts should be open. If you go to court and ask for justice, the public has a right to know who you are. But this case is now dragged on for more than a year. And the family that originally bought the plot, the one that wants to have the grave moved, still hasn't been officially identified, although we think we know who they are.
And in fact, I was going to say it's a name that an awful lot of people in the Northwest would recognize, in particular because their name is on some fairly prominent edifices at Oregon State University. Do you want to say? Because you think you've nailed this down, and you're a careful guy, Nigel. You know what? I think we just had a problem. Let's get Nigel's connection back. I don't know what happened. We've got some new phone companies involved, and they're screwing us up left and right. And at some point, they screw us up enough. Maybe I'll talk about their name as well. This is really irritating, but let me get Nigel back on the line so that we can do that. Nigel, sorry about the connection problem. Can you tell my audience who do we believe the family is, because their name is well known?
Yes, according to some emails in the court record, Lars, the family appears to be the Reeser family, whose name is on the football stadium at Oregon State University. It's on the new Performing Arts Center in Beaverton. They've been very philanthropic. They own a very large company, Reeser's Fine Foods, one of the biggest private employers in the state. And so the lawyers representing Skyline filed some emails in a court proceeding, as part of this court proceeding, that they show that the lawyers for the family whose son is buried believe that the Reesers are this unnamed family. The judge has still not finally ruled on whether that name will have to be made public or not.
And the Reeser family could simply say, we're okay with taking an alternate plot, or the family of the young boy who was run over and killed could say, we're okay with relocating the remains of our family member, but neither side is willing to budge?
Neither side is willing to budge. And in fact, the Reesers, there is a young man, Alexander Reeser, who is buried about 20 feet from the disputed plot. So it's a very, very strange set of circumstances.
Well, let me ask you one other, and maybe you know this detail or not, but oftentimes a family might say, we want all our family members buried adjacent to each other. And so you buy a number of plots, and then you have grandma and grandpa and mom and dad and maybe son and daughter all buried in the same vicinity. Is that going on here as well?
There are some elements of that, although in the immediate area of Skyline, there are not other Reesers buried there, but I believe there are are plots that are owned by both the Reeser family and the family of the boy who is buried that are there. So there are those complications as well.
Well, and ultimately, you said the bottom line is that Oregon law says if you're buried in a plot, your family has absolute say about whether or not your remains are moved. Is that a correct understanding of the law?
I wouldn't go that far. I don't have full visibility on that, but I think that is part of the issue here.
Wow. Any idea how this is going to end up being resolved? I mean, oftentimes, if you've got a prominent family with a lot of money, they might just resolve it with money. But is that playing a role, too?
It hasn't so far. There were plenty of negotiations before this went to court. I mean, I think my understanding is the family whose son is buried there is just not interested in moving, and the Reesers, if that's who they are very interested in moving. There was a hearing yesterday, in fact, that I attended, and Tuesday that I attended, and so the case is very much alive and very much unresolved.
And when you attend a hearing like that, but they're trying to protect the privacy of these people, do the lawyers just stand there and say, our client, as opposed to a name of any kind?
Well, they're proceeding with a pseudonym, John and Jane Smith. So that was the pseudonym they used. There was a lot of discussion. The parties disagree very strongly about whether it's appropriate for the case to continue to proceed with a pseudonym. The lawyers for the family whose son is buried very much think the judge should force this case to be like almost every other case in civil court where the parties are named.
It should be. One last question. You've found, or Willamweek has found, some text messages from Congresswoman Val Hoyle, who I believe is corrupt, to this young lady, Caceres, who's involved in the Lamota weed business that gave a bunch of money to politicians. What do those text messages show?
Those text messages show that Rosa Caceres was communicating very frequently and in a very
familiar way with
Val Hoyle, who is now a congresswoman, was then the statewide labor commissioner. Unusual questions that Caceres was asking, considering her company was in a lot of trouble with Boley. There were a lot of pending Boley complaints because employees didn't think they were being treated very well. There were also instances in which Caceres was asking and receiving recommendations or letters of support from Val Hoyle, who, again, was a statewide official supposed to be looking out for workers. This was Caceres was part of a company that treated workers pretty badly, according to
the emails and the text messages. Nigel Jaquess won the Pulitzer Prize working for W Week. You can find those stories at WWeek.com. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment and talk a bit about yesterday's Washington primary results. That's next. When it comes
in a rocky political climate, he's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to jump right to phones, and then I'll get to some of the results from yesterday's Washington State primary. I actually thought they were very, very good. Joe Kent will be facing off against Maria Perez this fall, and I think he's going to beat her handily. Let me go first to Dan, though. Dan, you heard that story about the fight over the cemetery plot and which family should win. You have some inside info?
Yes, sir. How you doing? Love your show.
Thank you.
So my grandpa and grandma are buried at Finley Sunset Memorial, which is right off of 26 and Canyon Road. And Al Reeser has, I guess you would call it a crypt. It's a ginormous above ground, whatever.
Yeah.
All granite or marble or something. And, just out of curiosity, I walked over to that one day to say, hey, God, you know, who died with, you know, the real big setup there? And it's Al Reeser. So Al and Patricia are going to be buried there. I would assume his family's going to be very close, as opposed to skipping town. That's all I can contribute to that. But
oh, okay. So I thought you had some inside info on the situation, because you've got a family who buried a child there who died in awful circumstances, and they say they don't want to move that child to make way for the people who originally bought that plot. Who should win in that case?
I think the person that's there now, I think that should be able to stay myself.
Possession is 9/10 of the law, right? Even on death.
Yeah, I just think they should be the bigger people and just, you know, move somewhere else that's available to them.
My first inclination was, if your family has planned ahead and said, these are the plots that we've bought for our family members, they're laid aside for days ahead, and then the cemetery just accidentally sells it to somebody else, no matter how, you know, sympathetic their situation is, I feel like, hold on, you sold something that belonged to our family that was put in your care. So I kind of went the other way, but I see your argument. I guess what I wonder about is the family that's been fighting this fight, saying, no, we're not going to move our family member. This just drags it out, and I would think enhances the agony that they must have felt originally.
I would be irate if this happened to me. I have already purchased my own. Hello?
I'm right here.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I heard a ding. I purchased my grave ahead of time and everything because it was available, because I bought mine 3 feet away from Rowdy Roddy Piper in Tigers at the Crescent Grove Cemetery. I paid $4,100 for it. Now, I've made Facebook posts. I love it. It's cool. And if this happened to me, I would sue. I would be so irate, I wouldn't know what to do. But, you know, I don't know.
I get your point. If the Reeser family says, we've got a lot of resources, we can afford to get whatever plot we want for a member of our family, and we'd like the one we bought, but yeah, we don't want to disturb this family, I could understand that take as well. But it sounds like it's going to have to go to court. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars, love your show. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because I had an interesting day yesterday. I went out and saw Senior Senator Ron Wyden was in Forest Grove.
Oh, the one from New York?
I asked him about that because he brought it up first and it talked about his family and his kids. And I flat out asked him where he lived, and he said some story about how he dribbled the basketball down the street in Laurelhurst, and you could ask his neighbors, but that he and his wife spent a lot of time on a plane, and he said that because he married late in life and she already had a successful business in another city, he wasn't going to take her away from that. And I thought right then and there, you know, he had to make a choice, and he made the wrong choice for Oregon. So he might have been a good senator many years ago. I asked him politely to retire. You know, he's been there too long. I asked him about term limits, and he said, well, elections are term limits. And I felt like bringing up Maduro, but I didn't. But it was an interesting conversation, and, you know, he's not up for election for another 4 years. And it's just interesting to see how entrenched he is. Well, and there's just, you know, he's bulletproof.
You know, he is bulletproof because way back in the day, Bob Packwood, who's still around, but Bob Packwood, who's a U.S. senator, the Oregonian and the fish wrappers gave him an incredibly hard time. Why? He spent all his time in D.C., so much so he ended up with getting a divorce from his wife. But his only residence in Oregon was a single wide trailer on a piece of property owned by a friend. But that was his official residence. But it wasn't because he was living in Florida or New York or somewhere else. It was because he's a policy geek. So he spends all his time in Washington, D.C., or he did back then. And they gave him all kinds of grief. And yet, do you think Therese Bottomley or Helen Jung of the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper have done any stories critical of Ron Wyden for making his home with his small children and his wife and her business in New York City, 3,300 miles away from the state that he represents? That's the thing that bugs me. And more than
extends to your friend Nigel Jaquess, who you just had on the line. I emailed him on this last week, and you're right, nobody will pursue it. And it's not just the media, the fake news in Oregon. It's the law enforcement at the national and the state level, as you said before. Who's gonna look into it? Nobody. But you know, you look at this thing with Menendez, and senators are not above the law. And I think you know, Ron Wyden had his day, but he's now a corrupt, fraudulent politician, and I think he lives in New York. Otherwise, I mean, who can believe that your family and your wife run a day to day business and your kids are in New York and you live in Portland, Oregon? Come on.
And by the way, they're not teenager adult kids. They are small children. They go to private school. His wife has a business. She's She's a multimillionaire. He's a multimillionaire. She took out one of those PPP loans from the government for her bookstore business, and then she managed to get the government, the taxpayers, to pay off a PPP loan. I've never taken one, and the fact is, I think that was another fraud because she and her business were forgiven. I think it was more than $1 million that the Strand bookstore got, and that's another piece of corruption.
The Lars Larson Show. Is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. You can email talk@LarsLarson.com. You can even vote in our X poll. The question today, should the family of the guy who took the doomed ride on the Titanic submarine get compensation? I should have said submersible. Technically, that's what it is. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and I'd vote no. I mean, he knew the risks. Now, he didn't know that the company was apparently advised, no, this submarine is not acceptable for that kind of trip, but that may be what they're hanging their legal case on. The family wants $50 million. But if I was on the jury knowing what we know today, I'd say no, but I might change my mind if I heard the evidence. Now, what about the Biden-Harris administration that has for 3.5 years presided over the biggest land invasion of the United States of America in its entire history, counting somewhere between, I don't know, 12 to 15 million illegal aliens have entered the country. And yet to hear Joe Biden and Kamala Harris describe it, they say, oh, no, 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 Trump's years were far worse when it came to illegal aliens. And they claim that they're combating illegal crossings of our border. Is that actually true? Now that we'd bring on Jonathan Cho, who's a journalist at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Hey, Jonathan, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars. Just got back from the San Diego border town of Hakumba Hot Springs. And I thought that, we would see some real progress, but the illegals are still coming over.
They have a big hole in that wall. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, this border fence, which is an iron fence with barbed wire. We've seen the images on TV, people using rebar ladders to climb over from the Mexico side into California. You know, you would think that they would at the very least patch up or close up the ends of this border wall. But we went back after CBS's 60 Minutes several months ago featured this prominently, showing illegal immigrants from China flowing into this opening. And we thought it was going to be closed, but lo and behold, the video don't lie. Lars, I was shocked. It's still wide open.
Now, it's not only amazing because they're not making efforts to close it, but the fact that they're Chinese illegal aliens that are coming in, Jonathan, that's particularly troubling to me because, I mean, to look at China, you'd say, do you think people can just at a whim leave China, communist China, the mainland China, not Taiwan, at a whim? And the answer is no. I mean, any American who wants to buy an airplane ticket can fly anywhere they want out of the United States. I don't think that's true of Chinese nationals in communist China. And yet somehow tens of thousands of Chinese nationals have left China, flown in many cases, I understand, to Ecuador, and then they seem to know the exact path to take north to come thousands of miles up to the border and just walk into the United States. It seems like that opening and those illegals in particular would be a concern for the United States government.
Yeah, and you hit it right on the head, Lars. Somebody is helping these Chinese illegals, and not just the cartels and the coyotes, the smugglers, helping them get to this point, but there are TikTok videos now on social media literally guiding people to take a path in Mandarin and Cantonese to go to this particular opening in Hakumba Hot Springs in the San Diego sector. And again, the U.S. government knows about this, yet they're not doing anything to simply seal this opening. And that is what's so stunning.
I mean, does the, when you go to that opening, is there even any evidence that CBP has a presence there? So they're at least, I don't know, writing notices to appear in court to these people or somehow keeping track of any of them?
Yeah, well, look, first of all, there aren't enough border agents on the U.S. side. And around that opening, there are also the Mexican border agents as well. But no one's paying attention. They have to cover, you know, miles and miles of this border. And even when the razor wires cut down or somebody saws off a part of this iron border wall, you know, the border agents usually show up when it's too late. By the time it's too late, by the time everyone's gone through. And I, you know, did a series with Turning Point USA, a collaboration on this particular story during my most recent visit. And we spoke to neighbors who live right on this border on the U.S. side, who run small businesses, have these illegals now jumping into their backyard. So these neighbors have formed sort of these community watch groups, militias, trying to stop the illegals themselves, taking matters into their own hands because the border agents won't show up in time. And unfortunately, some of these neighbors have also been hurt.
Let me, and that's terrible as well, Jonathan. Are they suffering thefts and violence, or is it thefts, or are these people just coming through their property on their way into the United States? Jonathan, we're going to get you hooked up again. I'm sorry about that. We'll reconnect that, Joel, if you don't mind. I'm talking to Jonathan Cho, who's a journalist at the Discovery Institute, about the fact that we've got a wide open spot, one particular spot on our border. There are many of them along that big open border. And sadly, what we're looking at is a Biden-Harris administration that literally is telling the American public, we have a secure border. That's the director of Homeland Security who said that. Jonathan, let me ask you about these Chinese nationals. Did you get a chance to interact with any of them at all, and do they speak English?
I did get a chance to interact with some of the migrants who came over. None of the Chinese illegals at the time. When I was there, I connected with a few from, you know, Spanish-speaking countries. But again, I saw their passports. The Chinese nationals left paperwork, and there are translators now who are with these NGOs that guide the Chinese, help them get processed. And who knows where they're at now in the U.S. as they wait for their so-called asylum. We've heard the news and the headlines in Texas. Several Chinese nationals been arrested for allegedly helping the cartels now with money laundering. So again, like you said, I have no doubt at the end of the day, you have Chinese nationals here now who are here for the wrong reasons. And it's just extremely problematic.
Well, you would think that this would be one of the focuses of the reporters now covering the presidential campaign, and Kamala Harris in particular, because she was named the border czar by Joe Biden. He assigned her the job. She didn't do anything about it. And walls as well, to ask them, how is it you can claim we have a secure border when in fact we don't?
Yeah, and I wish the reporters continue to hammer that point home, because these two folks who could be the president and vice president of the U.S., you know, have questionable records. I mean, you know, Governor Walz in Minnesota, I mean, he has said openly, you know, invited illegal immigrants and has touted that his state gives out the best benefits. If you can tolerate minus 30 degree weather, he wants people to come to Minnesota. So you have, you know, leaders on the Democratic side who are clearly looking the other way and trying to blame others.
Absolutely right. In fact, Jay Cho, thanks very much. That's Jonathan Cho from the Discovery Institute. Walz was proud that he made his state a sanctuary for illegal aliens. Walz proudly signed a brand new law. In fact, you should see the signing ceremony. It's very clear that he was very happy to sign the bill that gave illegal aliens official government ID in the form of Minnesota driver's licenses. Back in a moment, we'll get to your calls, and we'll talk about Tim Walz's position on free speech in America, what he thinks it is, and more importantly, what he thinks it isn't. That's next. Folks, you...
Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I think we need to push back on this. There's no guarantee to free speech on misinformation or hate speech, and especially around our democracy.
That, of course, is Tim Walz, current governor of Minnesota, big-time Democrat, radical left-wing liberal, and now the vice presidential running mate to Kamala Harris. And what he says he believes about free speech ought to be front and center for an awful lot of people, including any of those people who might plan to foolishly cast their ballots for Kamala Harris and for Tim Walz as her vice presidential running mate. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you first in line. We want to hear what you have to say. Just stick around for a few questions from me. But about what Tim Walz said, this is a guy who says you have no right to free speech if the government decides that your free speech is inaccurate. Now, think about the implications of that. As far as I'm concerned, you have a right to free speech. It is a God-given right. Government did not give you that right. Government is forbidden by the Constitution and the First Amendment to take away that right. And yet Tim Walz, as governor of Minnesota, now VP running mate for Kamala Harris, is saying, no, you don't have any rights if we decide that what you're saying is inaccurate. For example, just recently, you could say, well, at one point, the government said people who say that the mRNA jab for COVID will not prevent you from getting COVID. They said that's inaccurate. You can't put that information out there. Well, it turned out to be true. In fact, Joe Biden himself gave speeches in 2021, just 3 years ago in the summertime, saying if you get the shot, the jab, you can't catch COVID. That is untrue, and I think he knew it was a lie when he said it. He said if you get the shot, you won't get COVID, you won't get sick from it, you won't die. That turned out to be untrue. So the government is now saying whatever it is that you say, if we decide that you're not telling the truth, then we have the right to get in the way of your free speech. And Tim Walz says you have no right to free speech. If the government decides it's hateful or if the government decides it's inaccurate, you don't have that free speech right. Well, consider this. What do you consider hateful? I consider killing unborn babies hateful, for example. I consider people who say we ought to take away all the guns of American citizens, I consider that a hateful statement. I consider a lot of what Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have said about MAGA Republicans and MAGA Americans, I consider that hateful. Nobody's going to take their free speech away. And by the way, vice presidential candidate Tim Walz has been poking at vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, pointing out that Vance went to Yale University, and he's done pretty well for himself. So Vance poked back today.
I grew up in a poor family. The fact that Tim Walz wants to turn it into a bad thing, that I actually worked myself through college, through law school, and made something myself, to me, that's the American dream. And if Tim Walz wants to insult it, I think that's frankly pretty bizarre.
But then it gets even worse, because I've told you already this week that what we know about Tim Walz is that he has lied about his military record. He has claimed that he was a command sergeant major in the Army National Guard. Now, I think we ought to honor him for his service in the Army National Guard. Although what's not to be honored is the fact that even though he took a deployment to Italy, because that was probably a pretty nice deployment, the minute he got deployed or was given orders deploying him to Iraq, he quit the National Guard. He had signed on for 6 years. In 2001, he actually signed on for another 6 years, 1 week after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And then he took assignments. He went to the Command Sergeant Major Academy, which is a two-year program, but he never finished. And yet on his official biography, he says that he is. And in fact, listen to what Vance says about his anti-gun attitudes, which tie right in to his military service.
He made this interesting comment that the Kamala Harris campaign put out there, and I bet they were regretting they put it out there now, because he said that we, and he was making a point about gun control, he said we shouldn't allow weapons that I used in war to be on America's streets.
Well, he did say that. Well, now veterans have accused Minnesota's governor of polishing up his military career. And the fact is, He was made a command sergeant major conditionally because he was still in the middle of the program. And the minute his unit got orders to go, he quit. He quit and he said, I'm not going. Now, based on his version of things, he had another 4 or 5 months to serve, but that was because he claimed that he had only signed on for 4 more years. The military says he signed on for 6 more years. In either case, he allowed his battalion, the 125th Artillery Battalion, to be deployed to Iraq without its senior NCO, its Command Sergeant Major, conditional, Tim Walz. He just quit as soon as he got deployed or was given orders for deployment. Listen to what Vance says about something that is a very serious offense. It's known as stolen valor.
Well, I wonder, Tim Walz, when were you ever in war? When was this, what was this weapon that you carried into war, given that you abandoned your unit right before they went to Iraq and he has not spent a day in a combat zone? What bothers me about Tim Walz is the stolen valor garbage. Do not pretend to be something that you're not. And if he wants to criticize me for getting an Ivy League education, I'm proud of the fact that my mamaw supported me, that I was able to make something of myself. I'd be ashamed if I was him and I lied about my military service like he did.
And by the way, to back up Vance, the New York Post is reporting the Minnesota National Guard confirmed today that Governor Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's vice presidential running mate, was demoted and did not retire as a command sergeant major the way he has claimed for years. He claimed it when he was a member of Congress. He said he was the highest ranking non-commissioned officer to ever have a seat in the United States Congress. He currently claims it on his official governor's biography as governor in Minnesota. He temporarily held the title of command sergeant major, but he retired as a master sergeant because he didn't complete the coursework at the U.S. Army Sergeant's Major Academy. I got to tell you something. I'm not a veteran either, but just like J.D. Vance is not a veteran, or J.D. Vance is a veteran, but Tim Walz is to be honored for his service in the National Guard. The problem is that when he claims to be something he's not, that's known as stolen valor. So listen to Vance talking about Walz simply dropping out.
What really bothers me about Tim Walz, it's not even the positions that he's taken, though certainly he has been a far left radical. You know what really bothers me about Tim Walz as a Marine who served his country in uniform? When the United States Marine Corps, when the United States of America asked me to go to Iraq to serve my country, I did it. I did what they asked me to do it, and I did it honorably, and I'm very proud of that service. When Tim Walz was asked by his country to go to Iraq, you know what he did? He dropped out of the Army and allowed his unit to go without him, a fact that he's been criticized for aggressively by a lot of the people that he served with.
Yeah, and it was the people he served with. There were people who wrote real objections back when he ran for office in 2018. A letter posted to Facebook after he first ran for governor 6 years ago, retired Command Sergeant Majors Thomas Behrens and Paul Herr said that Walz retired from his 24-year career in the National Guard after learning that his battalion would be deployed to Iraq, despite assuring his fellow troops that he would join them there. Apparently, that assurance was not a solid one. And I think that's why it matters. If somebody's running for vice president of the United States and asking for an awesome responsibility to be the second and the person just in case something happens to the president and he didn't fulfill his promises to his fellow service members, that's a concern. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Network. The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, one of the problems that we're seeing more of is not just more crime, but more crime involving extraordinarily young people in America. And it seems to be happening all over the country from coast to coast. I've seen reports of crimes in my own neck of the woods in the Pacific Northwest involving 12 and 13-year-olds. There was one the other day, although it may be an outlier. It had an 8-year-old kid who was part of a gang of people who attacked a group of teenage girls. and the 8-year-old was armed with a hatchet. I mean, it's starting to remind me more and more of some kind of dystopian landscape like you'd find in a Mad Max movie. So I thought I'd ask Zach Smith about that, who's a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-author of the book Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. Zach, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Lars.
What is happening with juvenile crime in particular in America, and is there anything that explains why it's happening?
Yeah, look, juvenile crime is absolutely skyrocketing through the roof, and one of the main drivers of the increase in juvenile crime, particularly in big blue cities, is the fact that the prosecutors in many of those cities have pledged never to prosecute juveniles as adults, even when they commit adult crimes. We're talking crimes like rape, robbery, carjacking, and even murder in some instances. Almost every state in the nation, not all, but most, have laws on the books that give prosecutors discretion where they can charge juveniles as adults in appropriate circumstances. But as with so many other things that these so-called progressive, I call them rogue prosecutors, have done, they pledge categorically to take those tools off the table. And as a result, juveniles understand that they won't be held adequately accountable for their actions.
I'm talking to Zach Smith. His book, along with Cully Stimson, is Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical. And I'm not sure I can blame this on Soros. I think this is something else, either in society, but maybe in, as you suggest, in the law. But let me address one little problem, because I'm not a lawyer and you are. There's a thing called the ability to form criminal intent. And is there a general agreement among lawyers, at least in the United States, that if you're under a certain age, maybe it's 10, maybe it's 11, that you don't even have the capability to form criminal intent? Or is that an outmoded idea?
No, that's certainly true. Very young children often cannot form that criminal intent. But I think it's important to highlight, you know, you mentioned the story of the very young child, the 8-year-old child with a hatchet. Yeah, that's a little bit of an outlier. What we're typically seeing in many cities is 13, 14, 15, even in some cases 16 and 17-year-olds going out committing violent crimes. Certainly teenagers of that age understand. They know they shouldn't rob someone. They know they shouldn't kill someone. They have the ability to form the adequate intent. And in fact, what we're actually seeing in many cities is gangs are going out and recruiting these young teenagers, in some cases 15, 16, 17-year-olds, to go do their dirty work, commit very heinous crimes, because they know if those teenagers are caught, they'll only get a slap on the wrist, if that. Whereas if someone who is 18, 19, or 20 years old committed the same crime, they would at least theoretically be facing much stiffer punishments.
Okay, let me ask you about a couple of other issues, because I like to give my audience some kind, because it's usually just, well, we'll talk about it at 30,000 feet, but what can you actually do? One is stripping SROs, school resource officers, out of school. But the second one is, and I don't know that this is the case in every state, but in many states that I'm familiar with, they have an idea that if you're underage, you can be found to be a delinquent, which is the adult equivalent of being a criminal, or you can be a dependent. And if they find you a dependent, it means you're a kid who needs help. And the court is going to say, we're going to impose something on you, but not as a criminal. We're going to impose it on you because you're a kid who needs help. But we, the court, are going to tell your parents and all the other people around you, this kid needs these things, and you will do them with these things. And if you don't, then you, the adults, usually the parents, will end up having to answer for it. And that's sort of a softer version that perhaps you could apply to those younger kids. Are those being used?
No, they're not, Lars. At least in theory, courts may be imposing those types of remedial measures, but then they're not following up. D.C. in particular is notorious for the dysfunction in its juvenile justice system, where you have juveniles who are out on ankle monitors going out and committing other violent crimes while they're supposedly under supervision. You have juveniles regularly missing check-ins, not following through on their school assignments, all of these things they're supposed to be doing, and yet at the end of the day, there's really no additional consequences for them not doing it. And so fundamentally, what we're talking about is a lack of accountability, a lack of consequences. And we've talked about it before. Criminals, for all of their flaws, they're not stupid. They understand the incentives they are given. And so until all criminals, but particularly in this case, juvenile offenders, understand that there will be consequences when they break the law, I think, unfortunately, we're going to continue seeing more of this lawlessness.
I'm talking to Zach Smith from Heritage. He is the co-author, along with Cully Stimson, of Rogue Prosecutors, How Radical Soros Lawyers Are Destroying America's Communities. The other idea that's just nagged at me forever, Zach, is there are schools who seem to act as though there's some bubble over the school that says, oh, if this kid had attacked that kid or attacked that adult outside of the school grounds, why, that would be a crime. But here we're inside this special bubble where crimes don't exist and we're not going to treat them as crimes. And there seems to be fairly thorough buy-in by a lot of the people who run America's government-run schools, the K-12 schools. And how can we address that?
Yeah, I think, again, you have to give accountability. You have to give consequences when someone commits a crime, whether or not it happens on school grounds or off school grounds. And, in fact, I think there's a very compelling case to be made that if a crime is committed on school grounds, in some ways that should be treated more harshly.
Okay, we're going to get him back on. I know we've been I tell you, I want to curse the phone company, because that's the problem we've been having. It appears our phone company is failing us. There's apparently a new provider, and I apologize to you for that interruption, but it is happening, and we're handling it best we can. But you can understand the frustration at this end. I mean, ordinarily, if I hang up on somebody, and that has happened occasionally, I'll take responsibility. Sorry about that, Zach.
Hey, Lars. That's all right.
Okay, so, Zach, we've had some phone provider problems, but tell me this. Should there be consequences, even harsh consequences, for schools that say a crime was committed in our school, on our grounds, under our supervision, and we are choosing not to act? Is there anything that we could use to really provide the stick in this case? There's no carrot. And say, you can't allow this to happen.
Yeah, look, it's about accountability, Lars. And if a crime is committed on school grounds, the person who commits the crime should be held accountable. And we're not talking about minor offenses, you know, kind of the typical school spats. What we're talking about are violent crimes, stabbings, assaults, those types of actions. The student who commits those must be held accountable. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that lack of accountability. And studies have shown that if you intervene early, when juveniles start committing these types of crimes, they have a better chance of getting back on track, of not developing into hardened career criminals. And yet, under the guise of so-called compassion, under the guise of, you know, supposedly helping these individuals, many on the left have taken the position that there really shouldn't be accountability for their actions. And that is what's driving so much of this increase in juvenile crime that we're seeing today.
Yeah, see, I would love to see those schools, because here's the thing, Zach. I think every one of the 50 states has a mandatory reporter law. So they say if a child's being abused sexually, physically, or otherwise, you are required, if you even suspect it,
right,
you're required to report it. So when the schools are aware this kid hit that kid, you know, even if the whole thing involved only children and not adults, then failure to report it is a violation of the law. But there's no civil way to go after it. Citizens can't go after it. It has to be charged by DAs. And I can't remember the last time I heard a DA actually charge somebody with violating the mandatory reporter law.
No, it doesn't happen frequently. I think that's something more DAs should pay close attention to. But look, Lars, how can we expect many of these big city DAs to charge someone with violating the mandatory reporter law when they're refusing to charge hardened violent criminals, whether they're juveniles or adults, in many instances?
I agree.
The work so you don't have to, bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, yesterday, the big primary day in the state of Washington, and we got some fairly good results. I wish Joe Kent had finished out in front, but after all, Joe Kent was one of two Republicans running against Marie Perez, the member of Congress who more than a little bit lied to the voters. Leslie Llewellyn was also running. So, with about half the vote counted, because nothing gets counted fast anymore, Joe Kent had 38.3%. Llewellyn had 12.4%, and Marie Glusenkamp came in at 46. You just take Llewellyn's votes, because Llewellyn last night endorsed Joe Kent. added to Joe Kent's numbers, and you're over 50%. That's a solid beat on Perez this fall. Ferguson, well, he's already declared he's the winner of the primary election. He will be running for governor against Dave Reichard. You know that Reichard should win this race. I'm sorry that Semi Byrd was even in it, because he had some honesty problems with the voters as well. Raul Garcia will be going up against Maria Cantwell. I'd encourage you to give him a lot of support, because running against a longtime U.S. Senate incumbent is a very tough road to hoe. And then you got Representative Pete Serrano, who's moving on to November, running against Democrat Nick Brown. And if there's any justice, it'll be Serrano as Attorney General. And by the way, outside the Northwest, Cori Bush, the second member of the so-called squad to lose re-election this year. I think America is sending a very solid message. This segment of the show brought to you by 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. To your calls now. Let's go first to Bruce in Bellingham. Hey, Bruce, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for your work on the show. Yeah, I'd like to comment on Joe Biden's misinformation statement a long time ago about the vaccination, the mRNA, and how you won't get the COVID. And right after the debate with Trump and his disastrous showing in it, he said he had COVID.
Yep, and
so
he's been vaccinated.
He's probably vaccinated to the hilt.
Yeah, he has been. He's been vaccinated. He's been boosted, and it doesn't seem to have done Joe Biden any good. Very good point, Bruce. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Steve in Bellevue. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I think I've heard you say before that you're not a big fan of boycotting, but I'm really curious who donated, and I'm sure it was several people, and maybe you know, but this huge $100 million that Kamala Harris raised, that was supposedly a record, I want to know who's funding her, because I don't want to support those manufacturers, retailers, whoever they are, teachers unions. I don't want to support those guys.
No, I agree with you. And by the way, Steve, I don't sponsor boycotts, but I tell everybody to vote with their pocketbook as well as voting with their ballot. And so the only thing I don't do is go on and say we're boycotting X or we're boycotting Y or Z. What I say is this is where I'm spending my money. I trust my audience to know enough to be able to say, well, then I think I'll do the same thing Lars is doing or not. I just don't think there's a need to have this group action of boycotts. But as for the $100 million, that was a little bit of a trick, because what happened was there were a bunch of big money donors representing about $100 million, and they all said, we're not giving money if Joe keeps running for reelection. They had decided after the debate and after his other face plants that he should not be running and he wouldn't drop out. So they said, fine, we're withholding about $100 million. The minute Joe was out and Kamala was in, they immediately loosed that money, which automatically gave her the money. So if you want to say she raised it, I don't think she really raised it. It was the tidal wave of money held behind the dam, and the dam was get Joe out of the race. Now, why they're funding her, she seems like an equally disastrous candidate, just in different ways than Joe. Let's go to Jim. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Lars, I think I have a partial solution to the single-family dwelling shortage.
Let's hear it.
And it's just 3 points. One is no person or entity that owns two or more single-family dwellings will be allowed to purchase an existing single-family dwelling. Hmm. And number two, those same persons are welcome to build as many dwellings as desired.
Now, hold on. So you're going to tell me that if somebody is a mom-and-pop landlord and they own two houses, one they live in, one they rent, they're not allowed to buy a third one? Because 40% of America's housing is provided by what you might describe, and it's not disparaging, you might describe them as mom-and-pop landlords, individual American citizens who bought a house for themselves, and then they bought another house and rented it, and when they get successful enough, they buy a third or a fourth or a fifth or more. You're going to tell them they can't do that anymore?
Yes.
How does that benefit anybody?
Well, it takes the wealthier ones and the people that the speculators out of that market and makes it more available for first-time home buyers, young families that are looking to get into their homes.
So does that mean only corporations will be landlords now and no more mom and pop? Because I think mom and pop landlords are the best.
No, I said a person or entity. That includes corporations.
So I guess we'd have to tell all those people to sell all those houses, except who are they going to sell them to at 7% or 6.5% interest? I'm not sure who's going to be buying. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
You ready for the bit show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls. I got to tell you this story about what J.D. Vance did this year. It is something I have never seen in a presidential campaign before, and I think it's a very, very bold move. But first, if you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our poll on X, we put up a brand new poll question every day. We've been doing that for about 25 years, and we try to make it as fresh as we possibly can. So let me tell you the background. The family of one of the explorers, there were five of them, who were killed in last year's submersible implosion. Now, you might have thought of it as a submarine. Submarine, something a little bit different. But remember when they tried to take that submersible down to the level of the Titanic on the ocean floor? And unfortunately, the submersible was crushed when it got down deep enough. And all five people, sadly, on that submersible died. So now the family of one of those people, his name was 77-year-old Paul Henri Nargolet. He was one of the five people on board that submersible. It imploded on its way to the wreck on the bottom of the ocean. His family now says they want $50 million in compensation for his wrongful death. I would say no. Knowing what we know at this point, because it did sound like the company knew that they were using inadequate equipment. They'd been warned about that a number of times. But it also sounds like everybody involved was also understanding that they were taking on a task that might actually end in their death or their serious injury. Usually when you do almost anything that is dangerous like that, you end up signing an agreement saying, I know it's dangerous, I'm taking it on anyway, no matter what comes. Well, in fact, I compared it to, say, taking a tandem parachute jump. I've done that a couple of times. Two was enough for me. And I know I had to sign off on some paperwork that said, you know, you're doing something that's inherently dangerous. If it doesn't work out well, it ain't our fault. However, does it change if we find out that the operators of the submersible knew about some of the risks that they didn't share with some of their customers? In that case, if you were sitting on the jury, would you give the family of Paul Henri Nargolet $50 million in compensation for his wrongful death? I'd still say no at this point, but I'll actually keep my powder dry on that and see if I find out something that would change my mind. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I'll tell you the details on what J.D. Vance did when his airplane landed at the same airport at about the same time as Air Force Two carrying Vice President Kamala Harris arrived. But let me get to that after I take Ron's call. Ron's been waiting a long time. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, you got to hand it to the Democrat Party. They did add to their ticket. I don't know how that's going to pan out, but, you know, come on. We got to give Walz credit when it's due. You know, he brings the Democrat sex change tourism from Minnesota national. So there you go.
Yeah, and he also brings the born alive babies of failed abortions. He brings that issue, which is so ugly. Most people, even the people who call themselves pro-choice, the ones that are pro-abortion, they don't even want to talk about it. If you ask them, well, what happens if there's an attempted abortion, but the baby lives? And you say, well, what do you mean what happens? I said, right now, in states like Minnesota, the state of Minnesota issued a report that said that there were at least a half dozen cases where that happened, and they just put the baby off to the side and let the baby die. And they didn't give it any kind of life-saving, you know, help of any kind. And this is an issue that's been around going all the way back to Illinois State Senator Barack Obama, who argued against any kind of medical limitation on doctors, insisting that if a baby is born alive, whether you intended for it to live through the abortion or not, if the baby is born alive, you have to give it some help. And a state senator at the time from Illinois, Barack Obama, argued, no, you should let the baby die. And that seems to be the position of the Democrat Party. There are so many things about Tim Walz that just would lend you to say, I mean, I told one of my producers, I said, by comparison, even though I think that Kamala Harris is an extreme left-wing radical from the left, Tim Walz makes her pale by comparison. I mean, this is a guy who had a lockdown order in his state, which was dumb. But then he set up a hotline where people could call in and narc off their neighbors and say, hey, my neighbor is violating the lockdown, so they could bring the authorities down on them. He signed a bill, famously, the tampon bill, that required tampons be placed in the bathrooms for all menstruating students. That includes boys and girls. So Tampon Tim, the governor, signed that bill. He signed another bill that gave illegal aliens the right to get driver's licenses in Minnesota. And as you mentioned, he signed a bunch of bills that established Minnesota as a haven or a sanctuary for children who wanted to get puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, or transgender surgery, as you called it, transgender tourism. So this is a guy who makes Kamala Harris look positively moderate by comparison.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that's going to be the platform of the year, but congratulations, DNC.
Isn't that amazing? They've managed to outleft even Kamala Harris. And, you know, Joe Biden, who always tried to portray himself as some kind of moderate, he was not a moderate, not based on his positions. He was a friend of a lot of the banks and credit card companies, but on most other things, he was not a moderate, not one little bit. Now, let me tell you what happened on the ground in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So you had Air Force Two, which is the airplane that carries the vice president. In fact, it can be the same plane that carries Joe Biden. But if Joe Biden is not on it, it's known as Air Force Two. In fact, one time way back when I was a reporter, I flew on Air Force Two with First Lady Rosalynn Carter. And got a chance to ask her a few questions as well. I mean, that was an interesting experience, but I was a reporter. I put my own personal politics to the side. Here's what happened in Eau Claire. When Kamala Harris's plane lands and then J.D. Vance's plane lands a short time later, they're both on the tarmac. So J.D. Vance walks over to both the Secret Service, who are guarding the plane, and a whole bunch of reporters who are apparently waiting for Kamala Harris to come off the plane. And here's what he said. It's a quote. I figured I'd come by and just get a good look at the plane because hopefully it's going to be my plane in a few months. But I also thought you guys might get lonely because the vice president doesn't answer questions from reporters and has not talked to reporters in 17 days. And Vance then asked the reporters, have they given you guys an explanation for why she won't take questions from reporters? I'd love her to just answer what she wants to do and explain why every single position she has had has now been changed. She pretends to be tough on crime, and there she is wanting to defund the police. She's the border czar, but she's opened up America's southern border. It's crazy. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Carlsbad.
He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. By the way, one little update. Those poor astronauts who were sitting up there on the International Space Station, they had gone up, and I think their original stay was supposed to be somewhere in the vicinity of a week to 10 days. They have now been up there for months, and now the Boeing spacecraft, the Starliner, that's not bringing them back because it has problems that the Boeing engineers on the ground can't figure out. They now say those astronauts are likely to be there until 2025. And it kind of made me wonder if they get to vote or not. But, you know, on a serious note, can you imagine being the family members of the people who are stuck up there, told that your loved one was going to be gone for maybe a week or 10 days? Now they've been gone for months, and now it's going to be many more months before they come home. Let's go to the phones at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's start with Randy. Hey, Randy, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks. I'm a longtime listener. And just based on that last message that you said about the guys up in space,
yeah.
I think I'd like to get a ticket up there and stay up there, especially if the new democratic regime comes in. I ain't sticking around, buddy.
Yeah, it could be tough, although some of us would like to send Kamala Harris and Tim Walz off to Mars if Elon Musk wants some original colonists for colonizing Mars.
Oh, Lord, man, I keep telling people, get me off this planet. Get me to another planet. But anyway, I digress. Yeah, Kamala, where is she?
Yeah.
I can tell you exactly where she's at. She's in school. And guess who the teacher is? It's Obama. He's got his little blackboard up there, and he's showing her what she should say, when she should say it, how she'd say it. They're giving her a full-blown education on how the government runs.
See, I originally thought, Randy, that it was simpler than that, that all he had to do was look at the attachment points for the puppet strings to put those on her, and that's all he needed to do. I had the theory, and I actually said it. I mean, I'm wrong a lot, and I always warn people of that. But I thought he knew he could control Joe. He surrounded Joe with former Obama staffers, and I thought, okay, now that he's out, and Kamala Harris is in, she might get a wild hair and think, oh, I'm actually possibly going to become president, and I'll start making the decisions. And I wondered if Obama and his wife held back their endorsement, which apparently people think is important, because they said, we're going to make sure we have the quid pro quo all set up with Kamala Harris before we give her the endorsement.
Right. Hey, by the way, did you by any chance see the OPB Biden's decision?
I did not. What was it about? What was the gist of it?
Oh, my God. It's on Joe Biden. It's 2 hours long. And let me tell you, everybody in this country should watch it because it tells you exactly why he hates Donald Trump. It tells you, it details his failures from start to the end of his career. And it's very objective. It's very, very well done. I never thought I would sit through 2 hours of Biden on anything, and I was riveted.
Well, tell me this. I mean, what was the gist of it? Because Biden has had an easy ride most of his political life. I mean, became a senator. He was so young, they literally had to double check the laws because he had been elected. I think he wasn't due to become 30 until the election or just before the election. And there were people saying, can you run for Senate when, you know, you're not quite the minimum age, but you will be the minimum age by the time you take office? And it turns out they decided he could. And for a long time, he made his career as the youngest guy in the U.S. Senate. And he was constantly telling the old guys, in fact, there's some great sound bites of him where he says, all these old guard guys should get out of the way for us, the young guys who are coming along. Now, of course, he didn't think that applied to him when he became one of the old guys. But then all the way through his Senate career, most senators have at least one or two things that you can point to, even the Democrats, where you say, what is this person known for? Well, he's championed aging issues or he's championed budget issues. I don't think Joe Biden is known for anything because I'm not sure he actually, I mean, he showed up, he voted, he did all that stuff, but I'm not sure he's known for anything. And then as vice president, the only thing we really know him for is being the point man on China and Ukraine, which put him in a position to advantage his Biden crime family in all the sleazy deals that they were doing. But if you had to point at Joe Biden and say, here are the things he got done during about a half a century in public office, what in the, even if you were a fan of Joe Biden, what would you say he accomplished?
Exactly. I can't think of anything.
And yet, I mean, you've got people like Nancy Pelosi. We didn't run the soundbite the other day, but Nancy Pelosi in an interview literally said, Joe Biden is such a consequential political figure that his name belongs on Mount Rushmore. Now, frankly, I think the monument to Joe Biden is all the rubble that you can see at the base of Mount Rushmore that they created when they carved the other four presidents' faces in. But this woman either believes this or feels like she ought to say something out loud, because the guy is not going out on top. He's going out as a failed politician who we get to suffer under for a few more months. But I mean, I don't see why anybody would think he is one of the most consequential politicians in American history and deserves his face up on the mountain.
I don't get it. And I saw that piece with Nancy Pelosi, and this is one piece that I struggle with: his legacy. I don't give a damn about his legacy. I don't think anybody else gives a damn except Nancy and maybe Mrs. Biden. What legacy? The guy comes from nothing. He started out in politics. He had a stutter. He was, you know, ridiculed, beat upon. But if you go and you look in this OPB special, Biden's decision, it shows you the frustrations that he's experienced to get him to the point of where he has only one outlet and one outlet only, and that's Donald Trump. Obama was treacherous to him. He ridiculed him in public, basically emasculated him in front of the government. And yep. He just had these continual trials of one step forward to get to the presidency, two steps back. So it really makes sense. You've got to watch it. I suggest everybody watch that.
Okay, I will take your suggestion. Have you ever heard the joke or the metaphor that people tell about the post-turtle? Have you ever heard of this?
No.
You're driving down the road, old country road, and there's a fence post. And there's a box turtle sitting up on top of the fence post. And people say, well, what does that mean? They say, well, you don't know how he got up there. He's clearly way above his actual level where he can operate, you know, because turtles operate on the ground. And he doesn't know how to get down. He doesn't know how he got up there. And he can't do much of anything while he's up there. And I think Joe Biden is a great example of a post turtle. If you had to say, what brilliant things did Joe Biden do that made him, you know, get the job, a single most important job on planet Earth, and that is president of the United States? You know, what great capabilities did he show the public? And the answer is, he wasn't Donald Trump. And now I think he deeply resents the idea that Donald Trump, who's been successful in so many different quarters, he's a celebrity, he's had a successful TV show, he was successful in turning a small amount of money from his father into billions of dollars as an adult. He agreed to give up about a third of his net worth to serve as president, and now he wants to do it again, and he doesn't get much in the way of thanks from a lot of Americans and all of the media. That's the situation. You got the Lars Larson Show.
Unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. You'll find the daily question every day written from the news of the day, and you'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X, also on my website at larslarson.com. Israel and Iran seem to be on the verge of a war that might just plunge the Middle East into chaos. So we thought we'd talk to Russell Berman, who's the Walter Haas Professor in Humanities at Stanford, but more importantly, a senior fellow at the bright little spot of red in the middle of that big blue Stanford campus that is the Hoover Institution. He's co-chair of the Working Group on Islamism and the International Order. Professor Berman, welcome back.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Is this war going to turn into a full-blown war between Israel and Iran?
You know, that's the question. We'll know very soon. Apparently, there are a lot of flight bans that are going into operation just hours from now, so there may be some intelligence that Iran will strike very soon. On the other hand, it would be very wise for the Iranians to listen to the diplomatic calls to restrain their response or not to respond at all. So we don't know. It's a very, very dangerous moment. There could be an exchange of relatively limited attacks, or this could spiral into a full-blown war.
Do you think, and judge them on their latest behavior, do the Iranians usually listen to that kind of advice?
No, but they also have a new president, Pezhakarian. Pezhakian, I guess, I'm not pronouncing that correctly. And he counted as a relative moderate. Now, there's the old joke, where are the moderates in Iran? They're in jail. Nonetheless, the alternative was worse, and there are reports that he had been pleading with Khamenei, the spiritual leader, the real power, not to respond excessively. A lot of politics are going on in Tehran, in the international world, and in Jerusalem, and I think we'll know very soon. As I said before, there could be minimal response. There could be medium-range response that doesn't cross red lines, or this could lead to something of a greater magnitude than we've seen so far. If Iran hits in a very brutal way in Israel, Israel's going to respond for sure.
Well, for certain, and then I want to get to how we ought to be responding, if at all. But let me stick with Iran for just a moment. What's the point of having a president when you have the president of Iran who isn't really calling the shots? You got the spiritual leaders who are doing some of it. And then don't we have a third element in the IRGC, Iranian Republican Guard Corps, who are kind of a lone wolf actor or some kind of independent actor, perhaps a bit independent of both the mullahs and the government of Iran?
The IRGC is certainly independent of the government. It's not independent of the supreme leader. But you're absolutely right. There are these three different power centers, and you know, this is the way dictatorships work, through chaos. I suppose the best analogy to the relationship between the supreme leader and the president would be maybe between a prime minister and a minister of defense in a parliamentary regime. But this is not a parliamentary regime. This is a dictatorship fueled by religious fanaticism. So all rational bets are off.
Is there any prospect for the Iranian people themselves to say this is the opportunity we need? Our country's in trouble, and because of its own actions, and this is the time to come out and demand some kind of major change in the way that Iran operates, or would that be out of the question?
No, I don't think it's out of the question. I think one of the distinctive features of Iran since 1979, since the Islamic Revolution, is that there have been waves of protest, of domestic rebellion, in effect, differently themed at different times, most recently around women's rights. But the West, and the United States in particular, has just let them down again and again. Nonetheless, the Iranian people are yearning for some kind of freedom that they do not have under this regime that suppresses them brutally. If there were an exchange that were to weaken the regime, perhaps there'd be another uprising in Iran. But that's just speculative hope.
I'm talking to Russell Berman. He's a professor at Stanford, also at the Hoover Institution. Let me ask you this. Is there Is there something that the United States government should be doing right now to try to head this off? And is it possible that's going on behind the scenes and they're not communicating it publicly? Because I never understood why Joe Biden came into office, immediately said, I want to get a nuclear deal again, which he never got. And it doesn't seem he's likely to get one now. But he immediately unfroze billions of dollars in assets and then told the Iranians he wasn't going to exercise the sanctions that Donald Trump had put in place. So then they went out and sold a lot of oil and are still today and making tens of billions of dollars that reinvigorated Iran. Couldn't he at least say to them, you're going to knock this stuff off or I'm going to reimpose the sanctions? But if so, why isn't he? And why aren't major, you know, players within the United States government demanding that he do this? I know the Democrats won't, but you'd expect at least Republicans would be demanding shut these people down.
Well, I think some Republicans are demanding that, but let's go through this step by step. There's talk about the amount of military aid that the United States gives to Israel, about $3 billion a year per memorandum of understanding signed by President Obama. That's mostly dollars to buy weapons produced in the United States, so therefore right. American jobs. $3 billion a year. The Biden administration recently released $10 billion of Iranian assets that it had frozen, and it has, by refusing to enforce the sanctions, it's allowed Tehran to garner some $80 billion in oil sales. So, in effect, the flow of dollars has been much more toward Iran than toward Israel, thanks to the Biden administration's catastrophic foreign policy on many fronts, including this one. What the United States could do, of course, would be to threaten a reassertion of the sanctions. It won't, because the Democratic Party leadership, the Obama-Biden line, is very much focused on appeasing Iran. Appeasement is in its DNA. Some of this is bad idealism. Some of it is sheer corruption. And some of it is a function of the network of Iranian agents who are operating in the government and need to be cleaned up. Now, if there were a different administration, things could be very different. Right now, what the Biden administration has done is sent some military force and carriers to the Eastern Mediterranean. It could threaten Iran that if it crosses some red line, then Iran itself will be attacked. But I don't know that the Biden administration has that kind of backbone.
No, I don't think they do. And I don't think Kamala Harris is there any indication Kamala Harris would be one dime different than Joe Biden on this issue?
Well, I think there are indications that Kamala Harris might be worse than Joe Biden, as hard as that is to imagine. Right. But no. Listen, I mean, Biden has a long history of engagement in foreign policy, often wrong, but somehow aware of that field. Harris has no foreign policy creds at all. Not that she has any immigration creds either or domestic policy creds, but foreign policy is certainly not her forte. She has in her statement, she has indicated that she is much more friendly to the pro-Hamas wing of half of the Democratic Party than Biden has been. So, yeah, there is a difference. Harris is worse.
Absolutely. That's Russell Berman from Stanford. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
It's Veronica.
Do you realize you can literally have Lars with you all day, every day? Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network, and you are not going to believe what Joe Biden said. Now, he said it in an interview that apparently CBS is going to run on Sunday morning. I mean, obviously, you don't get those politicians up at the crack of dawn at O'Dark 30 on Sunday morning to talk to CBS. So he did this interview, and it is absolutely stunning what he admits. But let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. 26 great radio stations around Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we attempt to serve the Pacific Northwest states of those three states with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis, if I can actually talk. But if you want to jump into the conversation, you're certainly welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, should the family of the guy who took the doomed ride on the submersible going down to the Titanic last year, the one that imploded, killing all five people on board, his name is Paul-Henri Nargolet, 77 years old, he died. And that's sad. But his family now wants $50 million in a wrongful death lawsuit against the sub's operator. I would say that Mr. Nargolet may not have known all the particulars, but he knew that going in a submersible down that deep under the ocean was a risky proposition, and it did not end well. I wish it had ended otherwise for him. I wish they'd had a fun trip and we never would have been talking about it. But now his family wants $50 million because he died. I would say no if I were sitting on the jury knowing what I know today. Now, yesterday's X poll went this way. Louisiana has now passed a law, first in the country, that says that judges are now allowed, if they are confronted with a case involving a child predator, someone over the age of 17, so an adult, who is whose victim is under the age of 13, boy or girl, that the judge now has as one of the possible punishments for that predator, castration. They can do chemical castration already. That's already legal under Louisiana law. Now this new law, signed into effect about a week ago, says that they can do physical castration as well. I think it's a great idea. And in fact, if you put it to a public vote in most places in America, I think it'd pass by a landslide majority. I said yes to the idea that other states should follow the same lead. Only 6% of you were naysayers, but boy, would I love to talk to those naysayers and say, well, why shouldn't we do that to somebody who goes out and chooses a child for the kind of perverted activities, rape of a child, sexual abuse of a child under the age of 13? What would you suggest we do? Give them a free ticket to college or something. But let me tell you about this interview that Joe Biden did, because this is stunning. I remember hearing for literally years that there were people saying Donald Trump won't accept the outcome of the election. And they said that over and over again. And then toward the end of his first term as president, they said he won't leave the White House. Well, he did. He got impeached twice and acquitted by the Senate. He left on his own power, didn't have to be dragged out kicking and screaming. The Democrats always said that's what Donald Trump and his followers believe in. He won't leave peacefully. Well, guess what? Joe Biden, who nobody's paying much attention to anymore because the guy doesn't seem to be in his right mind, even though he's still technically president. We know that somebody else has actually been calling the shots, most likely Barack Obama, who's been pulling the strings through his former staff that now surrounds Joe Biden. So the first interview that Joe Biden has done, sit-down interview, since he pulled out of the race for re-election. He did it with CBS. They're apparently going to run it on CBS Sunday morning. And he was asked, are you sure that there will be a peaceful transfer of power if former President Trump loses the 2024 election? And he said, if Trump wins, no. I'm not confident at all. And the New York Post says in the interview, I haven't watched the interview yet, he said before quickly catching himself, it's going to be interesting what he said. He said, I mean, if Trump loses, I'm not confident at all. Now, it's interesting because there have already been suggestions. I played you the soundbite yesterday of Jamie Raskin, who's a top-level Democrat, dimwit Democrat. And he's already saying, if Trump wins, and I think they're expecting he will win, in January, on the 6th of January, it's going to be our job to invoke Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, meaning the Democrats have already decided the likelihood of Trump winning is so great that they're already making plans on how they're going to subvert the election of President Trump. Let's go to Justin, who's a naysayer. Hey, Justin, welcome to the program. What's on your mind, and what do you and I disagree about?
Oh, it's about the castration law in Mississippi. I just see a couple things wrong with it that kind of raise an eyebrow. One, I mean, there's no way that law can be applied equally. It would, obviously, it's just for men. I think, and another thing as well, if they're going to have the discretion, the judge, to use it or not use it, it should be mandatory. They should have to use it on everybody. But, I mean, there are female predators, too, and it's more common than people think. So they need to come up with something equal for them if they're going to do that. It's just my opinion. But okay, other than that, I think it's a reasonable law. But
well, I think it is, too. And the only reason it's you know, that you're saying, well, obviously you can't apply the same kind of thing as castration to females. Well, that's because, you know, to put it delicately for a family show, males sometimes use part of their anatomy in the assault on a child. And for that, you get punished. And if you can't do that to women, we'll figure out something else.
The Lars Larson Show.